station has reset. I'm going to go to MAR in a minute, but Mr. Comment, give us your call letter, sir. K2RIW.
K2RIW, KC2FHO, John in Mount Laurel, New Jersey.
Very fine, John. We're going to go to you in a second. Mr. MAR, give me your full call. I should tell you, and then your comment. K2RIW, go ahead, Mr. MAR.
Now, Sim here at the game, and we've talked quite a bit on the that with high pressure with computer devices, parts can cause damage parts.
John's website, KC2S. MarineMagazine.com. You'll see a lot of equipment that he owns and maintains and so on. So get us some more of the inside hoop of cleaning out the laptop-like machines of their dustbin. Interferes with cooling. KC2SHO, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
K2RIW, KC2SHO. Yeah, what more can I say? So, depending on the model, you know, every laptop is built very different from another. Some are a little bit easier. Sometimes you just pop a keyboard and a bottom cover off, and it's amazing you can find the fans. Others, the fans are buried more deep. You need to really get the shell of the machine apart and get in there. You know, and maybe the thing is, if you can find a way to peer in from the outside, you'll even know whether that's necessary or not. And again, sometimes just getting through the easy, the primary access levels, if you will, may be a good way just to get a look inside. Maybe you can look through the back with a flashlight, try to look at the fan intake and the fan outputs, and you know, just determine. Obviously, you don't want to take something apart further than you need to. But in many cases, I'd be repairing the machine for some other reason, and you end up cleaning it out and finding just amazing amounts of dust and hair and pet fur and things like that. It's one of the things I kind of wish I had a photo gallery of all the things I found inside of a laptop. Sometimes even small pieces of change, other gear, you know, who knows what, broken plastic tabs, stuff floating around inside there. Sometimes it's quite amazing. But I don't know, do you have any questions? That's about all I can think of to say about that at the moment. I do have some comments on the operating system, if that's still an open subject, but I think you guys have covered it quite well. K2RIW, KC2SHO.
If these machines could talk, what a story they would tell. Now, we haven't lost the subject of operating systems. You obviously got a lot of comments on that one, so give us your comments on operating systems, John. KP2SHO, KC2SHO, K2RIW, on TechNet.
Give me a turn, I don't want to be amateurs on the telephone.
No, I didn't. I turned it back to John, KC2SHO. We've got some further comments on operating systems. Go right ahead, John.
Yeah, and sorry I didn't jump right in there. My nose was IDing at the time. Always happens at an inopportune moment. So operating systems, let's see, a quick way to say it. Operating system preferences are just about as diverse as political opinions. And anytime I hear someone ask, you know, what should I buy? What I would buy and what someone else should buy, you know, are two wildly different things. And I think be very careful of anyone who has a preference telling you that's what you should buy. Especially when they are a IT savvy or computer savvy, tech savvy type of person, because what the tech savvy person finds is annoying or useless or intrusive, maybe the exact things that a layman, a non-techie, may find absolutely wonderful and beautiful and useful. So be very careful. And as much as I love Linux and want to promote Linux, and Linux has so many different desktops that you really have your choice, forcing this upon someone as a solution to Windows may end up, losing your friendship. You may end up losing that person's friendship. Maybe that's what some people want sometimes. They want the tech questions to go away. I don't know, but just be very careful. Windows has its place. Apple operating systems have its place. Tablets and touch screens. Oh boy, that's a much longer discussion. The resolution you get with your touch screen, as far as navigation, being able to manipulate things. Try editing a photograph, you know, in a touch screen without some type of higher resolution device in your finger. And that, hopefully that gives you an image. Hope that's useful information. K4IW, KC2, SHO.
Thank you, John. Good stuff. Okay, Gabe next, KB2MAR. Give me a 30-second transmission first to make sure we're going to be able to hear you continuously here, Gabe. KB2MAR, K2RIW.
K2RIW, KB2MAR, Hawk Hopkins control point.
Whatever change you made, you're now there continuously. Wait for the four beeps and you got it.
I just wanted to warn you guys that when you use a vacuum cleaner to take out dust, especially from a laptop and you know, something that has a lot of static sensitive insulated circuits, what happens is the vacuum cleaner is going to suck air at a much higher velocity, and that in turn will cause static electricity. Then that obviously, as you guys know, the integrated circuits don't like that stuff. I think if the integrated circuits are mounted on circuit boards, they're less prone to static sensitivity. But once I had a charger, a microprocessor-controlled battery charger, I was cleaning it out with a vacuum cleaner, the side ports in the back of it, and once I did that cleaning, I turned the thing on, it wouldn't turn on. I had to reset it a couple of times. Just as a warning, you might want to keep that in mind. This is K2RIW, this is KB2MAR.
Yeah, interesting comment, Gabe. I do remember going through quite a few classes at Airborne Instruments Laboratory on the subject of electrostatic discharge, high voltage built up by static electricity, creating damage to circuits. And that problem is much more severe on a very dry, cold winter day. Therefore, maybe what a person should do is only blow out the air or only vacuum it out on a high humidity day in the summertime. Or if you've got to do it in the wintertime, wait until somebody's taking a shower and do it outside of the bathroom door where you're getting humid air. And the nice thing about humid air is that it almost doesn't build up static charge that you would get with dry winter air. Any feeling on that one, Gabe? KB2MAR, K2RIW in the segment.
Well, I believe that if you actually had the patience to open up a laptop and use compressed air from a can, I think you'd be a lot safer. The velocity from the compressed air, you'd have to hold. What I would do, see, what happens is if you have the tip of the compressed air from the can close to the part. Basically, you're only going to be focusing the air at certain locations, whereas if you have a vacuum cleaner at behind the port of a laptop, what happens is obviously the air is going to go through the whole system at a high velocity. What you said makes sense. On a humid day, there's going to be less static electricity generated because of the humidity, moisture in the air. That would be a good alternative to try when it's a less humid day out. Or if you just finished taking a shower in the bathroom, inside the bathroom, that air is nice and damp. And do it right after you take a shower. K3IW, KB2MAR.
How many 128s have you blown up in your lifetime, Dave?
None. I'd like to believe that Eric is going to tell us that with surface mount components these days, once the components are on the motherboard, they're reasonably static discharge safe. From just moving air. But if you want to be super belt and suspenders, doing it on a humid day or in the bathroom after a shower might be a little bit safer for that function. Although you've got another problem now. If you start putting very moist air into your computer, the dust has got something to stick to, and removing it might be more difficult. Maybe we're worrying unnecessarily here, Eric. What do you think? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Guys, let me point out a couple of things. Do you remember the original dual gate MOSFET without the diodes on the input? It was a very high impedance little FET amplifier, and the amplifiers came, the dual gate amplifiers came around, and then eventually they put the diodes on them. If you look at all the components that we use in computers these days, they're what we call VSD protected. And just about every input of every pin of every microprocessor and every peripheral just has a clamping diode on it. So, also the way that the circuit boards are laid out, and actually in a really human environment, the static is going to be non-existent, but the real problem is going to be having kind of say on your computer, which is a little bit of a different issue. If you're really concerned about the static and being in its right neighborhood, make sure you don't have the thing connected to anything, so if it discharges anything, discharges the case, okay. Now, it's a little bit of an extreme going to those lengths, but, you know, caution and error is not such a bad thing. You know, too much caution may be a waste of time, but sure, no, you didn't do anything bad. But then again, too much caution, like too much humidity, is not a good thing either.
Yeah, part of what Eric is referring to is the early days of the very good gas FET transistors with 0.7 micron, I think it was, gates with or length, as they call them. Very, very sensitive
transistors. There's shorting wire on them when you got them.
Yeah, but all you had to do with that MGF-1402 in the early days is pick it up and don't touch it correctly, or hold it by the source lead and wave it in the air. On a dry winter day, you might pick up enough static charge to damage it. I do remember the time when AIL bought some very special transistors that were good to 60 gigahertz with extremely fine gates inside with no protection diodes. And boy, were they easy to wipe out. You couldn't even breathe on them, you know what I mean? The worst electrostatic discharge situation, even for things that are mounted on a motherboard, is that you as an operator are ungrounded to the board. You're floating in space. You do whatever you do in your room that builds up a static charge. Let me drop it. You build up a static charge on your body that doesn't get discharged, and then with your finger, you point at one of the leads of a component, even if it's on a printed circuit board. There's a slim chance you can do damage. A human being can build up a few thousand volts real easily and not even know about it. The right way to get around that problem is a so-called wrist strap, which, by the way, has a 1 megohm resistor in series to make sure you don't electrocute yourself. And that wrist strap is grounded to earth, and the motherboard of the circuit you're working on is grounded to earth, and therefore, in theory, you don't build up a voltage differential between the two, and now, in theory, you can point your finger at components without damaging them. Is this roughly what we're referring to here, Eric? And imagine that on some of the video circuits you worked on, you had to do some careful grounding of the human beings to make sure you didn't do damage. KE2EJ, K2RIW, the tech man.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, think about this. You're going to sit down at your computer. You just walk across the carpet. Humidity is maybe 5% to 10%. Sit down at the keyboard, you put your fingers on the keyboard, and ouch! But yet the computer keeps working. And if you were to measure that discharge, you'll know that it's got a lot of zeros with it. Ultimately, as the kind of gear that I work on here, you gotta consider that during the average thunderstorm, I'll get whacked by lightning a couple times a night. So there's gonna be some real static charges all over the place, and this stuff's going to have to learn to deal with it. But, going back to the 3N128, the dual gate MOSFET, once you put it into the circuit, and even though it was a high impedance circuit, you had a lot of places where charges couldn't really build up, they would get bled off to another place. If the whole thing's floating, you got nothing to complete the circuit with, so it becomes a non-issue. That's the reason for the actually net conductive cable that you put your work on. Actually, you don't really want to do that when you're powering it up because it's conductive. But while you're inserting and removing components, that little rest with the 1 megohm resistor is definitely the way to go. A component stand alone as opposed to being put in a circuit has a whole lot of different impedances around it. It's just half the force, so there's a certain amount of protection. And then, again, I put 99.9% of the components that, or at least the semiconductor components that you use in the various different computers and stuff, have a certain ESC rating, which, you know, has an allowable amount of zap without going, you know, without letting the smoke out.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
We only lost the last 2 seconds, Eric. When they model a human being for electrostatic discharge purposes, I've forgotten the exact numbers, but I got the round figures. I think a human being floating in space is roughly a 100 picofarad, maybe it's a couple hundred picofarad capacitor. As a human being walks across a woolen rug, you can easily build up 5 or 10 kilovolts of voltage. And how much energy is stored in that human being? 1/2 CV squared. C is capacitance in farads. B is voltage in volts. 1/2 CV squared. The answer is joules of energy. Well, you can build up some... You're only building up millijoules most of the time, but some of these very, very delicate gates of really fancy transistors, very high-frequency, low-noise transistors, can't take a millijoule of discharge to high voltage across it without doing latent damage. If not permanent damage. Latent damage means you've done some partial damage that at the time doesn't show. You measure the parameters on the transistor and you're happy. You measure its noise figure and its gain and whatever. And then all of a sudden, 2 weeks downrange, it decides to go bad because of what you've done to it 2 days. So you've got to be a little bit careful with electrostatic discharge. And quite often, it's not obvious. Yes, when you touch a keyboard, if the guy has done a good job of touching the keyboard, he's made the keyboard protected. But there's a hell of a lot of times in which you're discharging your voltages on your body into components on the circuit that you're touching where you don't feel anything, and yet the amount of discharge is enough to do damage. So we're getting a little bit off of subject here, but the original subject was recommendations for computers, laptops, tablets, operating systems, for a bedridden person who wants the amusement of a computer and wants to be able to, let me drop it. Wants to be able to go on internet, email, Facebook, order parts off of Amazon and stuff like that. So recommendations for computing hardware at not huge prices that can solve the problem from a bedridden person. If you have any further questions or comments, give me your call letters right now. K2LIW, the TechNet.
Send it back to me, Dick.
K2KIQ.
Let's get that. K2KIQ. Give me your full call, KIQ, and your name, sir, and then your comment. K2LIW, the TechNet.
It's Brian. Call sign is KD2KIQ. As far as doing that kind of stuff, you don't really need a whole lot of horsepower. I would probably just recommend a Chromebook. The battery life is good. There's cloud storage, so if you spill a drink on it and you ruin it, you know, not all your information is lost. If you wanted to get into gaming or something like that, then the sky's the limit. But yeah, personally, I would just recommend a Chromebook.
Brian, what is the approximate price of a Chromebook?
I believe they start around $250, which from my standpoint is very reasonable. Anything else, you know, more powerful with a discrete graphics card could start, you know, around $600. So as long as you're not doing a lot of heavy-duty number crunching and rendering or anything, I think the Chromebook would be ideal. Yeah, they start around $230, $240 for an 11.5-inch screen model. K2RIW, KD2KIQ on the TechNet.
This is Chromebook from Google. It's
$169. Yeah, run that by again, Eric, and give us just a tiny bit more audio. I think you're saying the latest thing you saw in, was it Amazon or something like that? K2EJ, K2IW, please repeat.
Alright, if you go to the Google store, shop on Google, Asus Chromebook, $169, that's the Google store, $149 by George, also on Google, so $149, I'm working way up.
I got 180 in Target, for mine, back to you, Dick, WS2N.
Very fine, Paul, and Eric, when you buy that particular deal that you're looking at, Eric, what software, what firmware, what operating system, what all comes with it? Is that a bare bones machine that you have to add a bunch of goodies to it? Over to you, Eric, K2IW.
No, the quite honest, Dick, I'm looking at this on my iPhone, so it's probably just funny. I suspect the Chromebook has Google's operating system on it, not the Windows. Although, I could be wrong, but I don't think so. But, I'm really not the right person to ask here.
Okay, Chris, KB2IQN, if you're still with us, do you have any comments on the Chromebook? Over to you, Chris, K2LAW.
Just easier if I actually transfer from here. I haven't used the Chromebook. It's a version of Linux, but it's specifically something that Google put together. It's somewhat limited, so it's meant to be used mostly online, like I think it was Paul was talking about. So, but I can't talk too much about it only because I haven't used it myself. KB2IQM.
Is that great?
Okay, Paul, you said they're great.
Yeah, then I cut out. I don't know, my radio's getting a little noisy here for some reason. I think I gotta change the external speaker. But it's got the Chrome operating system, and it runs all the Google. It's got Google Drive. It's got, comes with, it's got the, you know, instead of Notepad, it's Docs, they call it. And you could put anything on there. You could write a book on this thing and put pictures on it. It automatically brings up your email. And the great thing is it boots up in, I'm going to say, 2 seconds. I open this thing up and it's on. Back to you guys.
Yeah, we've got lots of good information tonight. For a person to play back all that information, under normal circumstances, you go to www.amateurradio.tangovictor, and on that mic number one website, mic is KC2 NJI, you get all that information. Well, right now, the last recording there is May 29th, and it's not working yet. So there's going to be a little bit of a delay so before people can place it back, but at least it's all there. So, I hope this was helpful, Rich, and maybe you've got some further follow-up questions on all of the above. N2EO, the guy who asked the original question, K2IW and TechNet, you got it, Rich.
Hey, Dick, N2EO. Yes, it is. Very informative. And I did go on the internet on Walmart, and I saw a Chromebook for like over $200. I'll check it out. I just hope you don't get confused with the Chrome operating system. How do you use the Microsoft? I agree. I don't like Microsoft either. I use an Apple Mac, and I do have a PC laptop, only for the purposes of programming radios. Software, ham radio software that's not supported by any other system. Memory check. Think you said one thing, called her my mother. She's not my mother. When I met her, was it almost 6 years ago? I gave her a laptop at that time. She gave it down to her. Actually on it immediately actuated with each other. I don't want to help her out. She's not totally dead, but she
I'm not sure I used that word, Chris. I mean, Rich. But if I did, I'm sorry. Mr. Godwell, it's your lady friend who is bedridden. Okay. I think we've covered that subject reasonably well for the time being. We can always approach it again next week. Every one of us has got the problem that we can all make mistakes. To really screw up requires a computer. So by the time we get the right computer, the right software, the right firmware, the right hardware, the right operating system, the right skill of operating it, whatever, the right applications, none of us have completely smooth sailing throughout that whole process. Maybe my son Chris does, but I don't. My wife doesn't either. From time to time, we get glitches in our computer where it does things that make us use some strong, salty language from time to time. We've used up the usual amount of time for the first question and answer period. I'm going to pass it over to the net. If somebody's got a burning question that's got to be answered immediately before we go on to the mailbag, give me your call letters and name right now. K2LIW listening.
NY2H Mobile.
There's a man who's got burning questions. NY2H, go right ahead, Lou. K2LIW.
Yeah, good evening, all. Just two things that you might want to address later on. You mentioned Elon Musk before. Apparently, Elon Musk believes that we're in a simulation. We're in the Matrix. You can find that on the web. Maybe you want to address that. And the other thing is, I think recently they discovered that the universe is expanding a bit faster than they thought initially, by about 5 or 8%. Using, I think, Hubble and Cepheid stars. And if that's true, that's kind of, they have to tweak Einstein's general theory of relativity. So maybe you want to touch on those two sometime before midnight, maybe not. But I'm going to listen out. I'm on the road right now. Back to Ned. This is NY2H.
Very fine, Lou. Lou, are you coming through the 975, 375 input at this time? Go ahead.
Roger, roger.
Yeah, when you come in that way, your audio comes out a little bit heavy. Eric has got... I know that setting the gain between those two machines is always a little bit difficult. But yes, the...
Typical, just lazy.
Okay. That stamp of yours you've got, Eric, all you've got to do is send one of your helpers out there to reset those knobs and having some fun with them. Beyond roughly 5 billion light years of distance, all the material out there in the observable universe, which goes out to 13.7, 13.8 billion light years, beyond 5 billion light years, the material is accelerating away from us. Between 0 and 5 billion light years, if I understand correctly, the material is slowing down. So what's causing the so-called dark energy that's making the stuff expand? And I think most of those measurements were done with one A type supernovas. I think the Cepheids are only used for slightly smaller distance measurements, but there I'm not sure. So we're finding out more and more about our universe, and as Paul's going to be telling us later on, some brand new hardware is being built that's going to tell us a lot more in the near future. Good job.
Did you guys see the nova from 2 weeks ago?
Give us a few words on that nova, Eric. Go ahead. And by the way, Gwen Ifill is back, and she has lost quite a bit of weight. KE2EJ, K2LAW.
Yeah, she had a health problem. I can't remember the name of the episode, but it celebrates Hubble and all the discoveries that Hubble made. And looking into that place in the sky where they could see absolutely nothing and came up with incredible numbers of galaxies and how they interact with each other. And you're correct, there was the A1A galaxies that they were making their measurements with. Sorry, I can't remember the name of it, but it's there.
Do you have reason to believe that particular NOVA program is going to be repeated? And will you be able to come up with a name so we know how to look for it, Eric? Go ahead. By the way, I presume if I go to the PBS website and dial in local channel 13, local channel 21, They will tell me when that particular program is being repeated. Over to you, Eric. Wait for the beep.
Oh, Dick, you are so yes to you. Go to pbs.org and watch the damn thing there. You can get it right out of your computer.
Yeah, you can. Not always can I. There are certain videos, because of all the protection built into my system, certain videos, I'm not able to easily play them. But that's going to be fixed in the near future, not to worry. What was that comment?
You could just go annoy your son, go out and buy a window cleaner.
Well, if I brought a Windows machine into this house, no, not going to do that. Now, so we're finding out more and more. It's the Super 1A supernovas, which are supposedly a standard candle of known brilliance. That's one of the major methods that was used. And then the ultra-deep field Hubble measurement, where for roughly either a million or 10 million seconds for a number of weeks, they aimed Hubble in one specific direction, in one very narrow chunk of sky. The chunk of sky they were looking at looked like it was dark, looked like there was nothing there, like integrated for a million seconds, and you see 2,300 galaxies that have never been seen before. The amount of sky they were looking at is equal to what you would see if you were looking at a postage stamp at 100 feet. That's the amount of sky they were looking at. Very small amount of sky. And the majority of what they saw were very deep, very far away, total galaxies. Each galaxy has between 100 and 300 billion stars. And as I said, they saw 2,300 galaxies that have never been seen before. So, how far does observable universe go? And by the way, out at the limit of the observable universe, you think it's starting to get sparse and you're seeing the outer edge? No way. There's as much stuff out there as there is here. So, we have an observable universe. Is that all there is? Absolutely not. Let me drop
this. Oh, they say it's 14.5 billion years old.
For lots and lots of years, they've been using the number 13.7 and 13.8. as far as the radius of the observable universe. So now they're slowly using bigger numbers, is what I think you're saying, Eric. 14.5. But if you think beyond 14.5 distance, that's the end. Absolutely not. And if you think there was only one Big Bang, and we just happen to be in the middle of that one, and that's all there is, no way in hell. I guarantee you there's a lot of other Big Bangs out there beyond our observable distance. In other words, it's moving away from us so fast that we can't even see it. And so, it is my belief that what's called dark energy, or repulsive energy, really is a dark suck. In other words, the outer universes are sucking our outer material away from us, and that's what's causing the speed up. That is my belief, and I think they're going to discover that. Another one of my beliefs in the beginning, when they're starting to find black holes in some of the centers of galaxies, they thought only a few of them had it. And I was guessing that, no, everyone will have it. Well, now they're agreeing. Every single galaxy has got a black hole in the center that holds it all together. So, we're getting into the space portion. We're getting ahead of ourselves here. I'm going to go over to John in the mailbag. I'll see what kind of deep questions we've gotten this week. KC2WGB, the mailbag expert, K2IW, the TechNet. You've got it, John.
WGB. Good evening, Dick, Paul, everyone on the net. Another Sunday night. Yes, we've got a few questions. We have been discussing microwaves and waveguide, and most of the questions that come in this week is about that. So let me let it drop, and I'll go on to our first youngster here who has a question. Okay, this young man is asking fairly simple question, and I wonder if it does exist. What he's saying is, in the radar system used in aircraft, do they have a system, if you know, that maybe a flight, a wing of bombers or fighters are out there, and they may have one aircraft that's actually in a position where it can transmit, and it'll transmit its radar pulses, and the other aircraft just received the ground image. Is that possible? Has it been done? Because he's thinking about, you know, the stealth quality and the ability to be able to be totally silent and also stealth with the structure of the craft, so it wouldn't reveal positions. Do they have a system like that working? If you know, back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
I pressed the wrong button. Am I pressed the wrong button on my computer? It was off. Yeah, thank goodness I'm listening. Absolutely, yes. When it comes to the word radar, how many kinds of radar, rather? Oh, boy, infinite kind. The majority of the radars are called monostatic. In other words, the transmitter and antenna structure that does the transmitting does the receiving. That's the so-called monostatic. There's quite a number of so-called bistatic radars where you transmit the radar pulse from position A, but a single or a whole gaggle of receiving antennas at some other location are doing the listening. And so bistatic radars are giving you a hell of a lot more stealthiness, a hell of a lot more difficulty of locating the receiving site, because they're passive and only being receiving. They're very difficult to locate. So are there kinds of radars like that? Absolutely. As I said, the word radar is an extremely ubiquitous word these days. There's all kinds of radars at various frequencies, various pulse durations, various pulse rep rates, various pulse chirp rates, various amounts of power, various sensitivities, various pulse compression techniques, bistatic, bistatic, polystatic. The word radar, it's no one simple chunk of electronics. It's a little bit like saying the word transistor. Is it just one kind of transistor? Hell no. So there's many, many kinds of radar, almost anything you can envision. And Mother Nature has done, let me drop it. Mother Nature really was the very first radar system from many, many points of view. What a porpoise does, what a bat does, is a beautiful kind of radar. The bat, for instance, when he's flying through the air, he's got a search mode, an acquisition mode, a terminal home mode, where he changes the way he sends his clicks, and he recognizes his individual signatures of his individual pulses. You can have 5,000 bats flying out of the cave simultaneously. In the dark, they're all chirping away, they're all listening to only their own echoes, and they almost don't hear the other echoes of the other 4,999 bats that he's flying out of the cave with. And how that tiny little brain inside of the bat head does all that, and he gets a three-dimensional picture by acoustics as to what's out there, and he can tell the difference between soft objects and hard objects, and living objects and non-living objects, and so on. What he can do with that processing on his system, you'd be amazed how many of the early radar techniques were doing the radio equivalent of copying what a bat is doing with acoustics in air. There's a whole bunch of people in England in particular who build ultrasonic acoustic receivers where they go around listening to their favorite brand of bats, and each species of bat has its own frequency, pulse rep rate, chirp rate, and so on, different ways of listening to their favorite bats that they consider their pet, so to speak. It's more popular in England than it is in the United States, but even in the southwestern United States, there are people who keep track of bats with the right kind of receiver and go walking around, taking the audio that's ultrasonic in most cases, translating it down to human listenable frequencies so that you can hear the bats as they go flying around. While I was doing a precise radar, a precise antenna tuning on the ratiometry antenna range in my backyard, you can read about that in the, I think it's the February issue, 1975, QSD Magazine, antenna ratiometry. While I'm doing that testing work at 2 o'clock in the morning, I was sometimes hearing some weird tones coming out of my electronics. I soon realized that at 2 o'clock in the morning, there were bats flying across my yard that I wasn't hearing. But I was hearing the radio equivalent of what they were doing with my antenna testing that was going on at that time. That's when I was developing the so-called 19-element insulated Yagi. Let me grab it. And there's a whole lot of words I could plug in as to how waveguide works. And the fact that the books describing waveguide, in my opinion, give you a very small fraction of the story, and they don't give you the story in an easily recognized or easily remembered form. Waveguide's good stuff. It's got a lot lower loss. At reasonable length, it's got a lot lower loss than coaxial cable at microwave frequencies. Almost all of the waveguide that guys use at 10 gigahertz, the ham radio operators at 10 gigahertz, is WR90 waveguide. WR means waveguide rectangular, 90 means 9 tenths of an inch. That's the width of a waveguide, 0.45 inch high, and that stuff's good, 4.5 dB per 100 feet, whereas a coax cable of reasonable diameter would have more like 14 dB per 100 feet than 10 gigs. So it gives you a lot lower loss. It's got no center conductor. It's a little bit of magic as to how that signal goes down there. Maybe this is some of the answer he's looking for, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet. I'm going to plug in one further comment. I wanted to build a bistatic radar. I didn't want to build the TR switch. I wanted a very, very short range radar. So I was transmitting from one feed horn, only a milliwatts of signal, a second feed horn a few feet away, both feed horns in my hand on a yardstick. I was receiving from the second feed horn while transmitting from the first feed horn. And the signal strength that leaked from horn number one to horn number two was so weak, I didn't even overload the receiver. And so therefore I made this radar-like thing that could measure all the echoes inside of an anechoic chamber to find out where the bad pieces of reflecting objects were. So to a certain degree, I once built a bistatic radar and held it in my hand as I was operating it. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Good, Dick. Yeah, no, you covered that pretty well. At least he knows now it does exist and it is being used. And sounds like something that could be very beneficial, especially in combat, for sure. All right, let me let it drop, and I'll go on to a waveguide question.
There's one more example I'm going to give you. When my 10 gig system on my tower was operational, and I've got to get back to getting that operational, there was a beacon transmitter in Princeton, New Jersey, run by that Princeton Ham Radio Club, that transmits a 10 gig signal, 1 watt of it, in all directions. And I seem to remember Princeton from me is like 90 miles away, and I would aim my 2-foot diameter dish on top of my 100-foot tower, I would aim it at Princeton, and 95% of the time I would hear a nice signal from that beacon. 5% of the time, because of crazy propagation conditions, I wouldn't hear it. But when a thunderstorm was coming from the west, and the thunderstorm has got a nice dense cloud of rain particles, which are beautiful reflecting objects at 10 gigahertz and above, I would hear the echo off of the cloud. So I would aim the dish at Princeton, I would hear a moderate-sized signal. And if I aim the antenna a little bit more clockwise, Princeton, as I remember, was 240 degrees from me, and if I aimed at 270 degrees, which was right in the center of the thundercloud, I would hear some nice, strong echoes from the thundercloud. Except the echoes from the thundercloud would be at a slightly different frequency, quite often higher in frequency, because the cloud was coming towards me at, say, 20 miles an hour, and the Doppler shift would give it a slightly higher frequency. I could also sense where the cloud was by where I would aim my antenna, and I could tell that the low-pressure cloud of rain usually had a counterclockwise rotation to it, because if I would aim a little bit to the right of the center of the cloud, I would hear a lower Doppler shift, and to the left I would hear a higher Doppler shift. So by hearing the tones coming off the echo of the raindrops from that rain cloud that was approaching me from New Jersey coming toward Long Island, I had a hint as to how far away it was, how fast it was approaching me. I was doing passive radar reception. That was a kind of vice
repeater. Time out.
You could say that was a kind of CW bistatic radar, in that
Princeton was transmitting a continuous signal, and I'm listening to the echo of that signal by aiming my antenna in various directions and interpreting velocities by way of Doppler shift. And by the way, the rain echo you get, because some of those raindrops are coming toward you, some of them are moving away, and they're all churned up in all kinds of ways. The nice pure tone coming out of the beacon transmitter, when reflected off that rain cloud, starts sounding like an aurora signal. If you listen to an aurora signal on 6 meters, for instance, the nice pure tone would come out, and as you would tune the receiver across the rain cloud frequency, you would hear. In other words, you would hear the tone, which is very rough in sound, change in pitch as you tune the frequency of your receiver across it. There's a lot of hidden information in that signal, if you know what I mean. KC2 WGB, K2LIW in the second half.
Oh, absolutely. A lot to be revealed there. I love that about the selective hearing of bats. That's incredible. Alright, let me go on to my next waveguide question.
Hey, Dick, did you have elevation control at that dish?
It was a 2 foot diameter dish, 3.5 degree beam width. Most of the time, the echo came to me right from the horizon. No, I didn't have elevation control. And, by the way, whenever a signal you're listening from the atmosphere is more than, let me pick a number, 20, 30 miles away, it's always within a couple of degrees of the horizon, with rare exception. The guys are using their 10-gig dish on a tripod at a beachside environment when they're listening to somebody a long distance away. There have been a couple of rare occasions where a guy would find out the signal peaks up 2, 3, 4 degrees above the horizon, but that's fairly rare. So, elevation control, I wish I had it. I didn't have it, Eric. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
K2RW, K2EJ. I was just curious, because my hops, of course, are not, they're close to the horizon, but they're not on the horizon exactly. I mean, we could still go a few more miles, but you know, without an elevation control, I would never get them pointed at each other. But I was just curious with whether you, I mean, I know you have a nice tall tower, so you're over all the trees and everything, so you're pretty much all set anyway.
When you heard the signal at some number of degrees above the horizon, are we talking of an S-band, KU-band? What roughly frequency range? And how big was the dish you were using, Eric? Go ahead.
Okay, we got one at 7 gigs, and that's a, what, that's a 2-meter dish? Oh, no, 2.5-meter dish. Then there's some KA-band stuff, but that's a little closer. It's also... the dish is a little bit smaller, so. And then there's some more stuff at 12 gigs.
When you use your elevation control to peak up on the signal, what to your memory was the maximum number of degrees that you tilted above the horizon? And when you peaked the signal that number of degrees above the horizon, was the signal always arriving to you that exact number of degrees above the horizon? Day to day, or do you have a way of tuning it in elevation from day to day, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LIW.
K2LIW, K2EJ. Well, we're not talking about satellites here, okay? This stuff is fixed, so you sort of set it and forget it. You get enough dynamic range in the link path that you create to compensate for, you know, little bits of atmospheric disturbance and stuff like that. Actually, I think about the 7 gig stuff, the digital stream that we're doing, the receiver is getting, and this is from 30 Rock, the receiver is getting, what, about a minus, between minus 49, minus 53, and it varies up and down, it doesn't stay put. I mean, when we get good rainstorms, it goes down to like minus 60, 61, something like that.
Yeah, the subject of propagation, that's a fun subject in itself. I mean, when I was day in and day out, every Tuesday, for 4.5 years, K4CAW and I ran an experiment where over the 480-mile overland pass between me and Greensboro, North Carolina, on 432 single sideband. Kilowatt of power on each end, 16 Yagis on my end, 4 Yagis on his end, 100 feet of power on both ends. How in the world did that signal go 480 miles when my radio horizon is 40 miles away? More than 10 times the distance, 12 times the distance of my radio horizon. How in the world did that signal get there? Boy, we were so excited by that. That's why we kept running that experiment for 4 years. He's now a silent key.
That's kind of why I'm wondering why, you know, an elevator control wouldn't be useful with the angle at which it comes at you change your signal.
I think the answer is yes. Only by a few degrees, but the answer is yes. And an elevator control, well, an elevation control, and also an elevator. The array of 16 Yagis, I could flip switches on it so that I would turn power into, I could transmit power into one Yagi, one vertical string of 4 Yagis, or all 16 Yagis, a 4x4 array, each one of 19 elements, so 304 elements total. I had a second antenna at the 70-foot level of the tower, identical antenna. And there were times when I flipped back and forth between the two, and the 105-foot level antenna almost always had 10 dB more signal than the antenna at the 70-foot level. But on a couple of foggy nights, let me drop it. On a couple of foggy nights, there were a couple of these periods of time when the signal at the 70-foot level, the antenna at the 70-foot level, would have a slightly stronger signal than the antenna at the 105-foot level. Not easy to explain why that takes place, but it did. And those were 25-degree beamwidth antennas, so tilting the antenna in elevation was not required. That wasn't it. Each of those antennas could be located only in azimuth. And how in the world could the signal be stronger at a lower altitude, just barely clearing the trees? That's not an easy one to explain. Maybe you can explain that one, Eric. KE2EJ, KE2IW. I want to repeat that experiment, by the way.
Well, if you do, you're going to have to put your stuff back together. No, I don't want to try and explain it. I have enough trouble explaining things to my folks when things happen that they don't understand, so. At least, I think I understand some of them, but I'll leave this one to you.
One of the main ways that they explain how a signal goes way beyond the horizon, and you can use that signal way beyond the horizon. It gets pretty weak, but if you've got a big enough receiving antenna and a strong enough transmitter, that signal is always there. They call it forward-propagated tropospheric scatter. In other words, between me and Greensboro, North Carolina, there's a whole lot of little bitty weather cells, atmospheric inhomogeneities. And when that radio signal hits each of these individual weather cells, it might be just a column of hot air, if you know what I mean. But the column of hot air has a slightly different dielectric constant than the cold air that's around it. When that radio wave hits it, it thinks it has hit, you know, a balloon of air that has a slightly different velocity factor, and that creates scattering. So the little bitty chunks of slightly different weather between me and Greensboro, 480 miles away, each one of them is scattering some signal. Call them great big raindrops, if you like, but they're miles in diameter. And so, how far can a signal go beyond the horizon in the ordinary atmosphere? There is no limit. It gets weaker and weaker by a predictable amount. But if you've got the right power spread, enough effective radiated power on the transmitter, enough, let me drop it. Enough area on the receiving site, and the receiving site antenna aimed in the right direction, and maybe dynamically aimed in the right direction, with enough sensitivity of the receiver, a low enough noise figure, there is essentially no limit. You go to the right IEEE site, you can find out about experiments that were done from Round Hill, Massachusetts, all the way down to the Carolinas, and I think they ran experiments out to 800 miles. The antennas that you were transmitting with were great big billboard antennas at 400 megacycles, and 800 miles they were plotting signal strength. And in my case, a lot of the peaks of signals we heard were aircraft.